Hi everyone, my name's Kim. I have to apologize first of all. I'm battling a cold flu situation, so just bear with me as I work through this presentation. Okay, and I have no relationships to disclose. So I know I'm preaching to the choir when I give you some background information on the significance of HIV among this population, but so despite HIV prevention efforts over the last three decades, HIV prevalence among black men who have sex with men, or MSM, has continued to be extremely high. In fact, one study that was conducted by the CDC within five major US cities found that HIV prevalence among black MSM was found to be more than twice that of Hispanic and white MSM. Furthermore, the largest HIV transmission category among blacks in general is sex with men. And this accounts for nearly half of all HIV cases among black men and a substantial but unknown number of HIV cases among black women. So therefore, black men who have sex with men and women, or MSMW, can be considered a pretty high-risk population because they can transmit HIV to both men and women. However, little research has looked at this population, and in fact, the CDC currently only lists one best evidence HIV intervention for black MSM and none for black MSMW or MSMWs in general. So another variable that has come up in the literature is CSA, or childhood sexual abuse. And it's commonly been neglected within the HIV prevention literature, despite several studies having linked a history of CSA to a number of negative physical, mental, and sexual health outcomes. There's also been some evidence that has, it's contradictory in nature, but some evidence that supports that a history of CSA can be linked to the development of sexual identity. So in the literature, CSA is often defined as a person who before the age of 18 experienced any unwanted or forced sexual contact that can range from touching and fondling to intercourse, or had a sexual experience with someone who was at least 5 years older than them. CSA prevalence rates among males have been found to vary greatly, with some national studies reporting rates from 4% all the way up to 76%. So this rate, this range in rates of CSA among males can be explained partially by just the difficulty in assessing CSA among a male population, as well as the diverse ways in which CSA has been conceptually defined and operationalized across studies. So now on to the next big theme. Researchers who've done some research around HIV among black MSM and MSMW have suggested that perceptions of masculinity may play a role in HIV risk behaviors, especially among men who have a history of CSA. Social science and public health literature has characterized hegemonic masculinity or culturally sanctioned displays of masculinity as including aggression, the rejection of feminine characteristics, exhibiting stoicism, having a preoccupation with sex, being an economic provider, having an increased sex drive, and serving as a protector of both the home and family. The masculine role is especially salient among black men who are bombarded by stereotypes by both the media and society at large about what they're supposed to look like. In fact, in order to find this image for this slide, I Google searched the term, and I was just bombarded with pages and pages of images of hypersexualized and thugged out images of black men before I could find something that was a little bit more reasonable. So you don't have to go to the scientific literature to see sort of what the expectations of masculinity are. So, however, while many of black men do prescribe to these societal ideals of masculinity, some of the characteristics may actually be harder for them to achieve. Because of racism, discrimination, and a history of oppression, some black men may not have equal access to some of the attributes that are associated with masculinity, such as money, power, and status. So therefore, it's been theorized that some black men may attempt to overcompensate for these unattainable masculine attributes by overemphasizing masculine traits that are actually within their control. So researchers such as Majors and Bilson have deemed this phenomenon among black men as the cool pose, and these characteristics that I listed before are oftentimes associated with that ideal. Furthermore, overarching negative attitudes toward homosexuality within some black communities can further complicate expectations of manhood for black men, MSM and MSMW. So displays of hypermasculinity may become a way for black MSM and MSMW to buffer discrimination that's based on sexual orientation with black communities and also buffer racial discrimination within the broader culture. So while acting out a typically masculine role can have its protective attributes. It may also encourage black MSM and MSMW to participate in hypersexual behaviors that may increase their risk for HIV. So in order to explore these themes, we sampled, we did conducted two separate focus groups, and each of these focus groups met twice for 90 minutes each. The eligibility criteria were that you had to identify as African-American or black, be HIV positive, and at least 18 years of age. We were looking for people with histories of CSA, but we did not outright ask them, are you a survivor of sexual abuse? Because a lot of times, these men do not appraise their sexual abuse as abuse or even as a negative experience. So we actually asked about early sexual experiences and then probed them to find out if these were indeed sexual abuse. We also wanted them to have had unprotected sexual activity with a male and female partner within the last 90 days, so they're behaviorally bisexually active, and also not identify with the gay label. So the focus group's discussions were facilitated by the principal investigator, Dr. John K. Williams, who's an assistant professor, the Department of Psychiatry and Biobehavioral Sciences at UCLA. He developed a focus group discussion guide, and all four focus group discussions were recorded, transcribed, and analyzed using consensual qualitative research and a constant comparison qualitative method. So in terms of our focus group participants, there were a total of 16 men. One group had 9 men and one group had 7. The mean age was about 40 and a half years old, and about half were unable to work or were currently unemployed, while about roughly 38% were working either part or full time. Just under 3/4 of the men had completed some high school, or some college, and the sample was relatively low income, with the majority of men earning about $20,000 or less. So now onto the juicy stuff. So, as required by the eligibility criteria, all of the men had experienced CSA. However, not all of the men necessarily appraised these experiences as negative. In fact, one participant who had a positive appraisal of his CSA experience said, "My first one was this guy down the street. I don't know how he thought I would do this, have sex with a man, but he did. But anyways, I knew I wanted it. I was already feeling that way. It really didn't matter if it was a molestation or whatever, because I knew what I wanted." Also, while some of the men did believe that having a history of CSA, some of the men also believe that having a history of CSA did influence their sexual identity. One participant who'd been abused by an older female babysitter said, "I was 9 years old and my babysitter forced me to do things. I really believe that this is the reason why I do not like women. I tried to be straight, but I don't like the way it feels. I feel safer with men. A lot of men don't say things like this because we are supposed to be strong and make the woman feel safe. But what about us?" The men also made a connection between their early experiences of sexual abuse and their perceptions of masculinity. For the most part, the sexual experiences were framed as almost being a rite of passage into manhood, even though the situations that they had sex in were technically abusive. For one participant who was abused by a man who had been assigned to him as a big brother, he said, "It was like my big brother. He used to do things with me like play ball. And my mom really liked the idea of me having a big brother. But one day he took me in the garage and he pulled the door down. He told me he was going to make me a man. That was it. I knew I couldn't tell my mom because she thought he was good for me." Another participant acknowledged that having sex with his older uncles was wrong, but he also believed the sexual experiences enhanced his masculinity. He said, "And it just made me feel like a man being able to have sex, even though I knew those were my uncles. I know that's wrong." Several characteristics also emerged within the discussions about what these men thought made a real man. One of the themes that came out was being a provider in the more traditional heterosexual sense. One man stated, who had raised by his mother, said that she instilled this in him as a child. "For me, being a man wasn't taught about sex. There was no sex involved with that. It was teaching you how to raise your family, be responsible, and to really take care of your family. That, to me, would be a man." Some other things that came out were this idea about not showing emotion and having to act hard. In fact, one participant not only highlighted the vital importance of hiding emotions, but also talked about the consequences of showing an emotion. In the black community, boys were always told that you're not supposed to show your feelings. You're not supposed to cry. You're always supposed to be hard. By your uncles, by your father, older brothers, stuff like that, and other men outside the family. You were always told that. That's where a lot of black men get confused, because they have all these feelings building up inside of them, and yet they don't want to show these feelings because they feel they're either going to get beat up by their uncles, get a whooping by their father because they're showing these feelings. So they get confused in their minds. But that's only if you play into that stereotype, because that's all it is a stereotype. In addition, it was told that not only being a victim of violence, if showing emotion, but in order to be a man, you had to be a perpetrator of violence. One man said, that's part of defining you as a man. Whether you black, white, gay or straight, you have to have the threat of violence within you, whether or not you could step up to it or not. You just can't be a pussy. You can't be soft like that and take it laying down. Anybody, you just don't take it. That, to me, defines manhood. And also, like I mentioned, sexuality also emerged as a common theme. Again, in several instances, having sex being considered another rite of passage into manhood. So one participant believed that not only having sex, but having sex at a very young age and with much older men really made him feel like a man. He said, it was like for young men who started having sex at a young age, because then for myself, it makes me feel like a man. And the men I was having sex with made me feel more mature. Also, the expectation to have sex with women, despite desires to have sex with men, was also identified as a more masculine trait. One man said, when I was growing up, I knew what I was back then, gay, even though I still had to have this, had to go fuck this girl, you know. Also, the intense need to fulfill a certain masculine role was specifically identified as a factor that impeded black men from getting HIV tested. One man said, I do have a problem with our Afro-American men not wanting to go have these HIV tests done because we're so manly and want to think that if they do find out, somebody's going to think that they're gay. That's the first thing. They can't go, you got HIV from playing around, you know? And finally, being gay or engaging in same-sex sexual behavior was repeatedly characterized as acting feminine, soft, and as basically being the antithesis of masculinity. Therefore, these participants, who despite engaging in same-sex sexual behavior, highlighted on several occasions how important it was not to act gay. Displays of hypermasculinity were considered particularly important when trying to buffer the potential consequences of being a sexual minority. One man said, you don't want people to look at you and go, he's a faggot, because you go every place that you want to go, because some people just don't accept that. You have to keep up that mask on society. You're masculine through and through until you get behind closed doors, and that's another altogether. But it's basic social perception. We still got, everybody has to be macho. Anybody have a little tint of femininity that's on them that's outwardly shown, they're put to the side. Another man said, as long as you acted rough and tough like they didn't care about you being gay. So in terms of the discussion, all the men in the sample had a history of CSA, and many of them claimed that it did influence their sexual identity. However, what I found was more interesting was that many of the men acknowledged that their earlier sexual experiences were abusive and or wrong, but they still believed that those sexual experiences enhanced their masculinity. So there seemed to be this disconnect between their negative feelings about the sexual abuse and their positive feelings about having enhanced their masculinity through having sex. Also, as highlighted through the previous quotes, the participants put great value on fulfilling the hegemonic masculine ideal. Furthermore, they felt it was important that masculinity was particularly important for black men, which they identified as acting hypermasculine, showing little emotion, acting hard, perpetrating violence, and engaging in acts of hypersexuality. Despite some of the men having acknowledged the hypermasculine role as an undesirable stereotype for black men, most of them did still prescribe to it. The expectations of being a real black man seemed to take an emotional and psychological toll on these men, as they felt pressure to carry out these roles by doing things like not showing emotion and sleeping with women, even though it's not necessarily what they desired. However, the participants did highlight that there were some upsides to acting like a man, particularly that having a tough masculine persona would allow them to demand respect as a black man within the broader majority culture. And secondly, that displaying a masculine exterior as a sexual minority would legitimize them as a man within some of the black communities, where same-sex sexual behavior was oftentimes frowned upon. So while acting like a man was considered protective in some respects, it seemed to also influence the men's decisions in regards to their sexual health. More specifically, the men believe that other black men were less likely to get tested for HIV out of fear of appearing gay or feminine or soft or unmasculine, and that it encouraged them to engage in higher risk sexual activities and to have more sexual partners, both men and women. So I've laid all this on you. In terms of recommendations, clearly the most important upstream for this thing we need to work on is we have to alleviate all forms of racism and homophobia, which of course is a huge order. But until we really get combat racism and homophobia at the various levels in which they operate, we're not really going to be addressing the root causes. But again, this is a complex and time-consuming process. In the meantime, future research should really examine how to assist men who have been victims of CSA in resolving their conflicting feelings around their individual experiences with sexual abuse, coupled with the societal pressures that they feel about being a man. Further, interventions must break out of the cookie-cutter approach to HIV prevention and begin addressing the unique needs of diverse populations, such as Black MSMW. Specifically, future interventions should be tailored to acknowledge the role that larger societal pressures, such as perceptions of masculinity, have on individual risk behaviors. This includes the ways in which HIV prevention messages are packaged, as Black MSMW may not respond to the traditional use a condom approach, when image to them seems to be, at times, more important than sexual health and safety. So I quickly want to acknowledge Dr. John K. Williams for the use of his data and also being just the most unbelievable mentor. Also the UCLA Center for Culture, Trauma, and Mental Health Disparities, and NIMH for their funding support. Thanks.